Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, American, European and RZVS Recognised Specialist in Emergency and Critical Care, Daniel Lewis. Thank you, Daniel. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thanks, Ema. Good afternoon, everybody. Right, here we go. Hemoabdomen. We'll talk about stabilization and we'll mention the use of water transfusion. We'll cover some other aspects as we go through as well. So what we'll do is we'll talk a little bit about how our patients might present or how they might acquire hemoabdomens. We'll talk about how we will approach these patients initially, how we'll triage them, gain a quick capsule history, and look at some of the clinical signs that we might, or that they might be displaying, and then focus down a little bit on how we're going to assess their major body systems and resuscitate any issues that we have with those major body systems. We'll talk about our diagnostic approach, and then we'll talk quite a lot about how we can medically manage our intra-abdominal hemorrhage patients, how we can stabilize them, and how we can get to the point where we make a decision about whether they require surgical intervention and at what point that is appropriate. So hemoabdomen or hemoperitoneum is defined as the presence of free blood within the peritoneal space, as it kind of sounds like it ought to, although really it ought to extend to include the retroperitoneal space as well. And I guess that's one key point to make quite early on, is that it is possible, obviously, to lose a life-threatening volume of blood into the peritoneal cavity in our companion animals, in dogs and cats, but they can also squeeze quite a lot of free blood into the retroperitoneal space as well. So it's important not to forget that little compartment. As with most veterinary conditions, the true incidence of hemoabdomen is unknown, as probably there's a degree of mild hemoabdomen, particularly following trauma, that is underdiagnosed. Some guidelines for treatment have been adopted, although no consensus on management of the hemoabdomen exists in either human or veterinary healthcare settings. Indeed, some strong disagreement exists between different countries, despite the existence of seemingly convincing evidence, such as the CRASH II study, which was performed in probably about 10,000 human trauma patients around about 6 or 7 years ago. And certainly if you're not familiar with the CRASH II study, it's probably worth looking it up on one of the websites that will summarize clinical papers. Having said that, there has been much human data generated over the last 15 years or so, unfortunately often coming primarily from a combat setting, and a number of trends are emerging which are likely to trickle down into veterinary medicine over time. And those trends seem to be an increased emphasis on advanced imaging, point of care coagulation analysis, and aggressive blood product therapy. And as I say, we'll talk about those, and we'll talk about whether some of those aspects are sort of translatable to our trauma and our hemoabdomen patients. So, in terms of etiology of the hemoabdomen in dogs and cats, two main categories exist: the traumatic and the non-traumatic, or the spontaneous. In terms of those etiologies, blunt or penetrating trauma is probably the most common cause. Certainly with a large number of dogs following motor vehicle trauma presenting with hemoperitoneum. There you can see the reference there from Boyson et al. 38 out of 40 dogs post motor vehicle trauma, road traffic accident, having hemoperitoneum. And a similar study, although quite not as much sort of data, quite not as many cases presented, but the Mongol study from around about 25 years ago found that the better your chances following blunt trauma are related to your size and how stable you are when you're presented to a veterinary surgery. So not massively surprising there, but hemoperitoneum post blunt or penetrating trauma, pretty common, and the bigger you are, the better your chance of survival. Again, between those two studies, we saw that there was increased survival for those being non-surgically managed. Now, what that probably means is that if your patients can get away without surgical management, they're likely to do better. Now, if we look at the reasons why we might get blunt or penetrating trauma, there are not going to be any surprises there. We're talking about road traffic accidents. We're talking about bite injuries, particularly big dog, little dog, or big dog, cat bite injuries. Unfortunately, we are going to see some cases of malicious injury. And equally, some of the time when we see hemoperitoneum, particularly in a referral setting, as the cases that I often see will be, some of those will be iatrogenic. They will be post-surgical. But we do need to remember those non-traumatic origins as well. And of the non-traumatic origins, something between 45 and 68%, depending on the studies that you read, will be neoplastic in origin. So roughly one half to two thirds of the non-traumatic hemoabdomens will be from rupture or bleeding from intra-abdominal neoplasm, okay, cancers. Those neoplasias are going to include any organ within the abdomen, but classically the spleen, the liver, potentially the kidneys, but also the adrenals will be tending to be more commonly hemorrhagic tumours in nature. As well as neoplastic reasons, we are going to see hematomata, possibly secondary to blunt injury that's not been identified. But as well, we may well see hemorrhage, effusion from malpositioned or ischemic organs where there's been necrosis and then rupture of blood vessels. And obviously, we're also going to see coagulopathies. Anticoagulant rodenticides can present with hemoperitoneums, as can platelet disorders and Angiostrongylus visorum lungworm infestation as well. We do tend to see a little bit of a difference between dogs and cats, with the CULP study showing that around half of cats have a neoplastic cause, with the majority of those, two-thirds of those, being related to hemangiosarcomas, usually in the spleen. Survival also tends to differ between the species as well, with feline survival for non-traumatic hemoabdomen, unfortunately being universally poor, around about 12 to 15%, irrespective of the cause. Dog studies, on the contrary, tend to report round about a 90% survival for non-neoplastic diseases and about, again, two-thirds survival for neoplastic disease, although that is going to depend upon the cause of cancer. As we all know, unfortunately, many, many splenic hemangiosarcomas tend to be malignant in nature, and although short-term survival for the hemabdomen may be high, long-term survival can be less good. As with all emergency patients, a standard approach to interrogation, resuscitation and stabilization of the major body systems needs to be adopted with these hemoabdomen patients. Whilst many of these patients are going to have cardiovascular and perfusion issues and abnormalities, the emergency clinician should remember not to neglect the remainder of the animal, particularly those major body systems, the respiratory system and the neurological system that may not be obviously involved in cardiovascular and perfusion abnormalities, but may well be affected by a traumatic cause that was the same reason why the animal is presented with the hemoabdomen. Now, stabilization of cardiovascular system abnormalities, stabilization of these patients, depends upon our ability as clinicians to assess their cardiovascular system and identify and define the level of hypoperfusion that's present. What we'll often do is we can segregate these levels of hypoperfusion into the compensatory stage, early decompensatory stage, and late decompensatory stage. And if our patients are coming in the late decompensatory stage, then if we fail to act quickly to stabilize them, they will progress quite rapidly to cardiopulmonary arrest. With animals in the early decompensatory stage, we've got a little bit more time, but again, we still want to be acting relatively in a timely fashion to identify the problem and act appropriately. The response to hypoperfusion is driven by the animal's sympathetic nervous system. It's driven by the response to the failure to stretch receptors in places like the aortic arch, the carotid body, and the kidneys. And those changes are not going to be specific to hypovolemia. Although a lot of our animals will be hypovolemic, they're also, particularly following blunt trauma, they're also going to be subject to other issues that may well drive a sympathetic response. Pain is going to be the most likely of those things. But if we do have a traumatized animal that's got a hemoabdomen, the presence of pulmonary contusions affecting oxygenation may well also drive a sympathetic response. So it's important to put our observations in the context of the whole animal. And as with any therapeutic plan, our cardiovascular system assessment needs to create a dynamic plan where we're not necessarily going to make all of the decisions or even find out all of the information immediately on presentation of these patients, but we're going to make an initial plan, we're going to try some therapy, some treatment, and we're going to need to see what happens as a response to that treatment. The majority of our determination of our cardiovascular and perfusion status is driven by our clinical findings. We're not in the situation where we need particularly any fancy machines, any fancy monitoring tools, or with the exception of a couple of measurements, any blood tests. Because we're using our clinical findings, all of our cardiovascular system assessments are going to be somewhat subjective. But classically, our signs should reflect an increased central cardiovascular effort together with an increased level of peripheral vasoconstriction as the level of hypoperfusion progresses. So on the table that's on the slide in front of you, instead of mild, we could have compensatory hypoperfusion. Instead of moderate, we could have early decompensatory. And severe would translate to a late decompensatory stage of hypoperfusion. So if we're seeing patients presenting with signs, and this is dogs particularly will fit this classic pattern, we're seeing signs in the severe side of that table, we need to be very, very concerned, and we need to be doing something therapeutically quite aggressively and quite quickly. But remember that all of our sympathetic signs, all of our sympathetic responses will be altered if we do have a strong pro-inflammatory process going on as well. That's not likely to be the case in any of our trauma patients, so long as they've been presented rapidly, although that may well be the case if we do have hemoabdomen secondary to the presence of a large neoplastic growth. That may well stimulate inflammatory markers, inflammatory cytokines, that may prevent the body vasoconstricting in the way it wants to. And in which case, we're going to see pinker, redder, more injected mucous membranes, possibly without a slowing of the capillary refill time as things progress. Although most of the other signs are still going to be similar. Unfortunately, we've got very few actual markers of tissue perfusion. But of those that are clinically available, lactate is probably the most useful. So in assessing our hemoabdomen patients that are presenting, that's probably the one blood test initially that is going to be very, very important. Although we will talk about a couple of others that can be useful to give us some information about what's going on in the abdomen in a few minutes. Lactate, unfortunately, does have some pitfalls. Traditionally, we would identify that lactate is produced in cells as a result of the switch towards anaerobic metabolism, and as such will only be really detected once it's been flushed out of those tissues. So if our perfusion is very, very poor, the lactate may actually be contradictorily normal until we've made some measures to improve perfusion. However, what we're now becoming more familiar with is that it's actually the level of catecholamines in the body, as produced by that sympathetic response, that drive the production of lactate from glycolysis, rather than allowing a slower aerobic metabolism. So actually, what lactate is doing is giving us a marker of hypoperfusion, a systemic marker of hypoperfusion, not necessarily what's happening on a tissue-by-tissue basis. So once we've identified, once we've seen whether our patients have got evidence of hypoperfusion, we need to come up with a therapeutic plan. And as we say, any therapeutic plan for any emergency patient has to be dynamic and involve repeat observations and defined intervention points as well. But overall, a general plan is going to be to restore and maintain an effective circulating volume, maintain oxygen carriage, reduce ongoing hemorrhage, whether that's into the abdomen or elsewhere, and then obviously diagnose our intra-abdominal and extra-abdominal injuries and decide upon a plan for definitive treatment. As with all of our patients, we need to ensure freedom from pain and distress. So first of all, we're going to talk about re-establishing and maintaining our effective circulating volume. A large number of human clinical studies and animal models, laboratory models for human trauma, intra-abdominal trauma, hemoabdomen, show the potential for adverse effects with the administration of large volumes of IV fluids post-hemorrhagic trauma. This was known as early as the First World War, although seems to have been forgotten as time's gone by. As a result of this, the concept of hypotensive resuscitation came to be popularized. And this, as we'll talk about in a minute, is an approach easily translatable to veterinary practice. There is no universal human consensus at the moment, but post-trauma, particularly post-trauma where there's a clinical suspicion of uncontrollable hemorrhage, so that's hemorrhage into a body cavity like the abdomen. Current NICE guidelines, so human NHS guidelines in the UK, are that in the absence of a head injury, IV fluid should be withheld pre-hospital so long as a peripheral pulse, that's a radial pulse in you and I, and probably a metatarsal or a dorsal pedal pulse in our patients. Those fluids should be withheld until the patient is in the hospital. As already suggested, data from combat trauma over the last 15 or so years would seem to suggest that the early and aggressive use of blood products can also confer a significant survival advantage in the face of massive injury. And the use of viscoelastic testing, what we would describe as sort of TEG or Rotem testing, so sort of two advanced machines that do a little bit more than perhaps look at the PT and the PTT, but again, patient-side testing, where they look at the interaction of all of the components of the blood. These are being used in human medicine to target blood product therapies and to target whether those are needed in trauma and hemoabdomen patients. Now, I just mentioned hypotensive resuscitation, fluid resuscitation before, and this technique focuses on in those patients where we've got potentially uncontrolled hemorrhage. So again, we're not talking about peripheral hemorrhage, we're not talking about hemorrhage from a limb where a dressing or a tourniquet can be applied to prevent that hemorrhage. We're talking about these patients where there might be hemorrhage into the lungs following trauma, or, as this lecture is focusing on, hemorrhage into the abdomen. And although permissive hypotension was originated for post-trauma patients, the principles are equally going to be applicable to our patients who have suffered rupture of intra-abdominal neoplasia tumors. And the aim of permissive hypotension is to maintain perfusion of the vital organs whilst avoiding the rapid elevation of intravascular pressure or flow in order to avoid disturbance of early clot formation. Lots and lots of clinical and laboratory evidence suggests that the first clot that's formed when a blood vessel gets damaged is the strongest clot that will ever become formed to plug that hole. So if we can leave that clot alone, the likelihood of ongoing bleeding from a site of injury will reduce. Given that autoregulatory mechanisms tend to preserve organ function and organ perfusion, if a driving pressure between 60 and about 160 millimeters of mercury is maintained, hypotensive resuscitation techniques aim to maintain this driving pressure between about 60 and 80 millimeters of mercury. Now, the driving pressure that determines the flow of blood into an organ is the mean arterial pressure. So, what we want to aim for is achieving a mean arterial pressure greater than about 50 to 60 millimeters of mercury. What that should do is that should ensure that each individual organ, particularly those organs where flow is very, very important, like the brain, like the kidneys, maintaining a mean arterial pressure in that range should enable them to sort out their own local perfusion and maintain organ function and survival. Now, mean arterial pressure is not always an easy parameter to determine in the emergency setting, and it's not always an easy parameter to determine in veterinary medicine. I don't know how many of you have got access to the ability to measure blood pressure, and how many of you traditionally just use blood pressure to monitor things like chronic kidney disease in cats. But the use of oscillometric, or probably more easily Doppler blood pressures in our patients, is equally important in the face of hypoperfusion and hemoabdomen, whether that's due to trauma or due to rupture of tumor. Doppler blood pressures, certainly in bigger animals, are going to measure the systolic arterial pressures, not the mean. So for that number, for our Doppler blood pressure, what we should be wanting to aim for is to get a Doppler pressure of at least 90 to 100 millimeters of mercury. What that's going to do is going to ensure that our vital organs are perfused. But what we know, again from animal models unfortunately, is that if that systolic blood pressure is maintained too high above 100 millimeters of mercury, then we are going to see rebleeding. And that's going to be true of our spontaneous hemoabdomens and our post-traumatic hemoabdomens as well. Permissive hypotension techniques seem to be associated with a massive reduction in mortality in animal models. So what we probably want to be doing is, if we can measure mean arterial pressure, aiming to keep that mean arterial pressure between about 65 millimeters of mercury and 75 millimeters of mercury. Or if we're measuring a Doppler blood pressure, a systolic arterial pressure, we want to aim to keep that between about 75 and 90 millimeters of mercury. If our patients are post-trauma, and as well as the hemoabdomen, we've got evidence of reduced brain function telling us we might have traumatic brain injury, we might need to aim for a slightly higher blood pressure though, but we don't really know. Remember, traumatic brain injury in our trauma patients is reflected in reduced neurological function, as in the dog on the left, not as in evidence of head injury, as in the cat on the right, who, as you can see, is bright, alert, and looking around at what's going on. He hasn't got a brain injury. We don't need to give him an elevated blood pressure. Permissive hypotension is actually the wrong term for what we're going to do in these patients. What we're actually aiming for is just enough normotension. Permissive hypotension is a phrase borrowed from human anaesthetists really in the 80s and 90s, where they actually allowed patients to become clinically hypotensive, so that's with mean arterial blood pressures of less than 60 millimeters of mercury, simply to stop surgeons complaining about bleeding. Given that blood pressures under 60 will destroy nephrons and probably other sort of subunits of other organs, we don't want to be aiming for that. We want to be aiming for just enough normotension. But how are we going to do it? When we're presented with a hypoperfused hemoabdomen patient, what we're going to do is we're going to titrate little boluses of intravenous fluid to achieve those blood pressures that we've been discussing. So we're going to give a small dose, a small bolus of 5 to 15 mils per kilo of a balanced electrolyte, like lactated Ringer's or Hartmann's, over perhaps 10 to 15 minutes, and then see what happens to the blood pressure. We're not aiming to get blood pressure normal. We're not aiming to get our heart rates of our patients back to normal. We're aiming for that Doppler blood pressure of around about 90 to 100 millimeters of mercury, and no higher. Bear in mind as well, we will talk about pain relief a little bit, but sometimes our patients will be maintaining a high blood pressure because they've got vasoconstriction because of pain. So you need to make sure that you've got your pain relief on board and then reassess your blood pressure and your cardiovascular status. If one bolus of fluids isn't enough to get the blood pressure where we want it to, then you repeat it and then recheck and repeat and recheck and so on until we get to our target blood pressures. We need to be careful with fluids that might cause rapid intravenous volume expansion unless that fluid contains possibly some things to help with coagulation, because again, theoretically, a rapid increase in blood pressure or flow might pop off that primary blood clot that we hope is forming. If we're faced with animals that are showing us hypotension and the presence of hemoabdomen, what fluids are we going to be best off choosing? Well, isotonic crystalloids are almost always going to be the best choice. With balanced solutions like Hartmann's, lactated ringers, compound sodium lactate probably being the number one choice. But if the first bag you reach for is 0.9% normal saline, then that's absolutely fine as well. Most of the time, we don't want to be giving any colloids, even if we've got access to them. Most of the time, we don't want to be giving a hypertonic saline unless we've got evidence of a traumatic brain injury, as well as our hemoabdomen. It probably doesn't matter what we give. Although some evidence from humans would seem to suggest that if we have got ongoing bleeding, giving fluids like Hartmann's or saline that will dilute our coagulation factors, it may well be that actually the appropriate choice is going to be a fluid that gives the body the ability to make clots, some sort of plasma product. But again, this is research that's come out of human combat scenarios, not the same as our patients. Next step, we need to make sure that we're maintaining our oxygen carrying capacity, because irrespective of what's going on in our abdomen, if we don't keep oxygen flowing to our vital organs, our patients are not going to survive. Now, whilst an acute intra-abdominal bleed may well result in a significant loss of oxygen carrying capacity, this is initially going to be masked. But as fluid resuscitation progresses, a significant reduction in hemoglobin concentration, or PCV, may well be revealed, potentially requiring the use of blood products. In almost all situations of trauma, hypoperfusion or hemoabdomen, providing supplemental oxygen is going to be of benefit. It doesn't need to be of big benefit, but it's going to help. The only time not to give it is if your patient is on fire. If you're in the situation where you think oxygen carriage may well be reduced because you can identify a significant amount of blood loss, whether that's into the abdomen or externally, then we probably ought to be considering the use of blood products. And there is an adage that says, if you as a clinician are thinking I should use some blood products, then you probably should. Acute hemorrhage is likely to result in physiological decompensation at a much higher PCV than in the chronic setting. So, rather than adopting a universal or a classic transfusion trigger of a PCV of 21% or a hemoglobin of 7 grams per deciliter, the clinician should be guided by the remainder of the clinical signs and other problems that are going on, as well as the clinical context of the patient. A young, fit, healthy gun dog that suffers a hemoabdomen following blunt trauma is probably going to be able to cope much more easily than an aged cat with chronic kidney disease that potentially gets hit by a car and has significant other non-abdominal injuries as well. So think of the context. Acute hemorrhage often results in physiological decompensation at higher PCVs. And to maintain oxygen carrying capacity, we need to give some source of hemoglobin. In terms of what options we have, so long as you can access a donor within the clinic, you can have fresh whole blood. You may well be able to get stored whole blood. You may well store whole blood, possibly from a blood banking company. And packed red blood cells or stored whole blood will be adequate in almost all situations. context of the acute hemoabdomen, however, one further source of blood that's cheap, readily accessible, it's already cross-matched, and it's got a good level of hemoglobin, is available in all of our hemoabdomen patients. And that's the potential to use autotransfusion. Autotransfusion, for all of those reasons, it's cross-matched, it's cheap, it's easily accessible, has been an important component of human perioperative management for a number of years, with good evidence that it's safe in almost every situation and beneficial. It's been used increasingly in veterinary medicine over the last 10 to 20 years, and a number of techniques have been described, from the do-it-yourself, such as sort of Robinson 2016, to the automated, using one of those machines that you can see on the bottom right there, from Kellett Gregory from JVIC in 2013. And pretty recent, fairly robust evidence that these machines that process the blood are both safe, effective, and maintain healthy red blood cells. In the context of the acute canine or feline hemoabdomen, the potential for contamination of salvage blood with bacteria or neoplastic cells must be considered. Although the use of inline leukoreduction filters do appear to reduce many of these concerns in the human setting, both following trauma, where there may be GI bowel, there might be gut rupture, or post neoplastic bleeding. At the very least, inline filters should be used if you're going to auto-transfuse, if you're going to salvage blood from within the abdomen and return it to your patient. Although what you'll find is that with a significant volume, so more than about 100 mils of blood, it's probably easiest to administer your salvage blood via an empty, sterile saline bag and a normal blood-giving set, rather than using an inline filter. The next concern is going to have to be to manage ongoing hemorrhage. Now, that's likely to be manifested as the failure to stabilize cardiovascular or clinical parameters. What we need to do is we need to compare our abdominal and peripheral PCVs, because what that's going to do is it's going to yield useful information regarding ongoing bleeding. Point of care coagulation assessment can again likewise reveal any evidence of a consumptive coagulopathy, as could ongoing deterioration in our clinical status, as we said, the failure to stabilize our cardiovascular parameters, and an increasing abdominal girth. If ongoing hemorrhage is confirmed or suspected, escalation of medical treatment, possibly abdominal pressure dressings, the administration of fluids that will aid with coagulation, should be instigated whilst the decision is made regarding surgical intervention. In terms of comparing the peripheral and abdominal PCVs, when the blood is initially lost, the PCV of the blood in the abdomen will match that of the peripheral blood. As soon as we resuscitate our patients with Hartmann's, the peripheral PCV is going to reduce, as we've already said. If there's no ongoing hemorrhage, the abdominal PCV will remain high. If there is ongoing abdominal hemorrhage, the peripheral and the abdominal PCVs will both reduce together as more fluids are administered. So tracking of the peripheral and the abdominal PCVs implies ongoing hemorrhage. As you can see from that slide. Putting a little bit more detail onto there, we've got evidence of coagulopathy. We can look at that history. We can do coagulation times in-house if we can. Even if that's as simple and as straightforward as a buccal mucosal bleeding time, we can check our platelet count. Again, we don't need fancy machines for these. We don't need sophisticated or expensive testing. Check a blood smear to look at your number of platelets. If we have got concerns with ongoing hemorrhage, then blood products are indicated. Fresh whole blood contains coagulation factors. Fresh frozen plasma is probably going to be the blood product of choice if it's available. And again, that's a product that's able to be kept in your practice freezer for a very, very long time and remain viable. So it's probably something that's well worth stocking. Administering vitamin K may well be beneficial, and antifibrinolytic agents may well be useful, although we don't have any evidence in our species really at the moment. There is significant evidence from human side that these antifibrinolytic agents are very, very valuable at very, very low cost in the face of uncontrollable hemorrhage. And certainly that CRASH II study that we mentioned before identified that the cost in human trauma patients with things like hemoabdomen, the cost per year of life gained was only around $60. That's in human patients. So potentially that may well be useful in our patients as well. Human evidence as well would also seem to suggest that in the face of ongoing hemorrhage into the abdomen that's uncontrollable, a balanced administration of red blood cells, fresh frozen plasma and platelets should be followed. Now that may well be advantageous in our patients, but we don't have the availability of platelet products and we don't have the evidence as yet. However, the administration of things like fresh frozen plasma are very, very unlikely to cause a great deal of harm. Abdominal counter pressure is going to be available to everybody though, irrespective of whether you store blood products or not. And in this, what we can do is we can wrap the abdomen and the hind limbs, creating an increased abdominal blood pressure that will stop bleeding from small blood vessels capillaries. It's not going to stop bleeding from arterioles, but it is going to stop it from veins and capillaries. It's going to reduce the peritoneal volume, and it may well help recruit extra blood from the hind limbs to the central circulation. We can use this as a temporizing measure, but it's also well worth considering in those patients where surgery simply isn't an option for financial reasons. Ideally, we would make sure that the intra-abdominal pressure doesn't get any higher than 25 millimeters of mercury. And certainly, we're not going to maintain this for very long, but certainly possibly an hour or two may well be enough to allow stabilization of an intra-abdominal bleed. Ideally, we're going to place a urinary catheter, the closed collection system, and we're going to be cautious if we have got pelvic or hind limb injuries. Although, if we have got uncontrollable hemorrhage into the abdomen that's going to lead to hypoperfusion and death, that ought to be our primary concern. But again, we're not going to leave this on for more than an hour, hour and a half or so. What we also need to do, although we've brushed upon it, and hopefully this is just going to sort of highlight some things that you're already well aware of in these patients, is we need to diagnose hemoabdomen, but also we need to remember other abnormalities that may well be present in these patients. We need a fairly comprehensive history. If our patients are arriving and they're showing evidence of hypoperfusion, then initially we're just going to get a quick capsule history as to what's happened. Have they been involved in a traumatic incident or not? Have they had potentially access to anticoagulant rodenticides? That sort of thing. And we're going to use that information in our initial resuscitation. but we are going to have to go back to the owner and get a more thorough history before we can properly get to the bottom of what's going on. We need to ally that history to our clinical signs. And as well as potentially getting a lactate when our patients first come in to give us some extra information about perfusion, then a full minimum database is also going to be useful. And that's going to consist of our PCV, a packed cell volume, and a peripheral packed cell volume, as well as the total solids. Again, quick, cheap and easy. A blood glucose, just to make sure that there isn't something else going on. Some measure of renal function is certainly useful. Urea or creatinine. Although you should remember as well that if we do have patients that have suffered some kind of trauma to the abdomen, and that is the reason for the hemoabdomen, we're unlikely to see increases in urea and creatinine within less than sort of 12 hours, even if we do have a rupture of the urinary tract as well. So if we've got bleeding from a ruptured organ and we've got urine leakage from a ruptured bladder or an avulsed ureter, we're not going to see spikes in urea and creatinine in the blood in the short period of time. We are, however, going to find creatinine in the abdomen, and that may well be useful. Measuring lactate would be good as well. Measuring electrolytes and blood gases can be potentially useful, although that is going to require some slightly more sophisticated point of care analysis machines. But we can do a blood smear very quickly and cheaply in all of our emergency, all of our post-trauma, all of our hemoabdomen and hypoperfused patients. Sometimes a complete blood count and a serum biochemistry is going to be useful, but not in every case. We've already mentioned point of care coagulation testing, and that's going to vary from the very straightforward estimation of platelet numbers from a blood smear through the classic coagulation testing of a prothrombin time, a PT, or a partial thromboplastin time, and an APTT, all the way up to these slightly more sophisticated viscoelastic tests like TEG and ROTEM that we'll undoubtedly see increasing in frequency in veterinary medicine over the next 10 years or so. Ultimately, to diagnose what's going on in our abdomen, we're going to need to take some fluid from the abdomen to see what it is. An awful lot of small animal practices nowadays do have ultrasounds, and the use of ultrasound in this kind of context, whether it's through a documented way of approaching acutely ill animals, like a TFAST or an AFAST technique, or just putting a probe on, is going to be fine. We're looking for the presence of fluid in the abdominal cavity. There shouldn't be free fluid in the abdominal cavity. It's not going to be a diagnostic challenge to any of you to identify the presence of fluid in the abdomen. If that fluid has a PCV similar to the peripheral blood, or possibly higher, and it's not clotting, then that's the very definition of the hemoabdomen. We're going to do a PCV and total solids and cytology on that fluid, but also running some other tests may well be useful. Lactate and glucose can help us determine whether there's any evidence of sepsis in there. Bilirubin can tell us whether we've got injury to the biliary tract and creatinine levels in it. And these are just run on a normal in-practice blood analysis machine. Creatinine levels can tell us whether we've got rupture of the urinary tract as well as potentially injury to a solid organ that's the source of our bleeding. Radiography is often very non-specific, and though it can help you, it will confirm the presence of free abdominal fluid. Sometimes it can help you identify organomegaly that may well be related to the reason why we've got the hemoabdomen, but it's often not that clear. If you've got a suspicion that clinically we've got a non-traumatic hemoabdomen, then consider thoracic radiography to screen concurrent disease. But ultimately, ultrasound is probably going to be our most useful diagnostic imaging tool for our hemoabdomen patients, not only to identify the fluid, but also for a rapid non-specialist look at the significant organs. The kidneys, the bladder, the spleen, particularly in the context of the hemoabdomen, but also the liver as well. Now remember that we're looking for gross abnormalities. We're not looking to get a specialist level of data or interpretation. If we do have significant injuries that are severe enough to cause bleeding, then you will identify them on simple, straightforward ultrasound of the abdomen. Computed tomography is the standard in humans for any hemoabdomens and is becoming increasingly available in veterinary medicine and will increase in availability over the next 5 to 10 years. Again, it's going to allow the evaluation of the rest of the body, will often allow the quantification of the level of abdominal fluid. If you use contrast, it can help you identify whether there is ongoing hemorrhage. And it will often give you pretty good information as to the source of the hemorrhage, the source of the hemoabdomen as well. However, these patients will often need chemical restraint. There are obvious cost issues as well as availability issues as well, and the technical ability to interpret the images that are generated, although a lot of telemedicine services exist to allow non-specialists to gain as much information from CT as we can. But that's the future. Coming towards a close, again, we need to ensure freedom from pain and distress. In our hemoabdomen patients, irrespective of whether they're secondary to trauma, blunt trauma, penetrating trauma, or they're spontaneous in origin and likely to be related to neoplasia, there's little, if any, contraindication to the use of opioids. Any of the licensed opioids, or again, there could be made arguments for the non-licensed products such as morphine, but ideally we ought to be using buprenorphine, fentanyl or methadone because we have licensed products in our patients. Again, consider titrating the dose, so start with a relatively low dose and titrate up to the level at which your patients become comfortable. Some of our patients will benefit from additional anti-anxiety drugs, such as the benzodiazepines, diazepam, midazolam, but we ought to be cautious with our classic sedative drugs like acepromazine and the alpha-2 agonists, because they are going to have significant impacts upon our cardiovascular and our pulmonary systems. Because what we want to do is we need to ensure freedom from pain and distress, but minimize cardiovascular depression, cardiopulmonary depression. These are not the patients, however, to be trying something new and exotic that you heard about in a webinar. Use what you're familiar, so that if anything changes, you know it's not due to the use of a novel drug or technique. Final big question for our hemoabdomen patients is we need to consider whether and at what point surgical intervention is required. The majority of traumatic hemoabdomen patients can actually be successfully managed medically, probably at least 3/4 of them. But you, as clinician in charge, have to examine the individual context to determine whether that's likely to be adequate. Is there clinical pathology? Is there imaging evidence of ongoing hemorrhage? Do you have an abdominal PCV that is tracking a falling peripheral PCV. Do you have imaging evidence of significant organ damage? Is there evidence of a disease that is only realistically going to be fixable surgically? Can you see a ruptured mass? Do you have evidence of a gastric dilatation and volvulus, where we may have hemabdomen secondary to rupture of the short gastric arteries? Do we have signs of visceral torsion? Do we have clinical pathology evidence of uroabdomen, pneumoperitoneum, bile peritonitis, or penetrating abdominal wounds, trunk wounds, where we are concerned that there may well be damage to a hollow viscus or penetration of the sterile abdominal cavity from the outside? Do you have something that is going to need surgery to fix it? The final question really is going to be, are you in your clinical setting going to be able to cope with the anaesthetic, the surgical, and the post-op care? These are not likely to be stable patients. They're likely to need a lot of intervention and a lot of support. It may well be that stabilizing these animals and transferring to another facility, or possibly recruiting more staff to assist, is going to be the more sensible approach, rather than necessarily diving straight into a surgical procedure in a cardiovascularly unstable patient. And then you need to decide when you go to surgery. Ideally, you want to be as prepared as you possibly can before you anaesthetize your animal. If you have evidence of ongoing hemorrhage, then ideally you should have some blood products available. Certainly be prepared to auto-transfuse your patients. Be prepared for hypotension. Be prepared for cardiopulmonary arrest. Prepare your patients as far as you can aseptically before you induce them. Attach your monitoring equipment. Make sure that all of the staff members are rested and ready to anaesthetize your patient, to pay full attention to what's going on in your surgical theater. Get everything ready that you might need. Get more ready than you might need, because the one way of guaranteeing that you won't need specialist tools is to have them ready. One question that is a very, very pertinent one in human medicine at the moment is, how far should an emergency surgery in a patient that has got a hemoabdomen go? We don't do damage control surgery, but that appears to be the future in human emergency surgery for things like post-traumatic hemoabdomens. Go in, repair some of the damage, and get out quickly, rather than necessarily trying to perform definitive repair in one go. Now, there are many barriers in veterinary medicine as to why we don't do that. The cost, the time, a dedicated pathway to refer these post-traumatic patients up, as well as the availability and the recognition of the importance that it may well not be definitive surgery that saves these patients, but it may well be the resuscitation and the intensive care that gets them through the immediate post-traumatic or post-abdominal organ rupture issues. But again, this may well be an approach that we have to foster for the future. The idea of damage control resuscitation incorporating damage control surgery. So in summary, with our patients that may well be presenting with a hemoabdomen, we need to re-establish and maintain effective circulating volume with minimally aggressive titrated doses of intravenous fluids. We need to consider the early use of blood products to maintain the oxygen carrying capacity, and particularly to think about treating coagulopathies in those patients that are showing us evidence that they are continuing to bleed following their initial issue. We ought to be reaching for ultrasound and abdominal syntesis as the mainstay of identification, diagnosis, and monitoring of our hemoabdomen patients. If your patient appears to be cardiovascularly stable, don't feel that you have to rush to intervene, as many of these patients, particularly the post-trauma hemoabdomen patients, will not ever require surgery. If you do have patients that have no choice but a surgical intervention, try and get them as cardiovascularly stable as you can first, but prepare for things going wrong. Think about sourcing blood products, having them available, thinking about having all of the surgical tools that you might need. And that includes having spare members of staff ready to hold things and assist. Have it ready prior to induction of anesthesia so that you're not surprised when things happen. Thank you very much for listening. And hopefully, there are no questions.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Daniel for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.